welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and professional speaker, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free Author 2.0 blueprint and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn and this is episode number 216 of the podcast, and today is 3rd of May 2015 as I record this on a pretty changeable spring day in London. Windy and wet one moment and then the sun comes out and it's gorgeous. So yeah, very happy to be working. And it's a bank holiday weekend in England, which means everybody gets Monday off. But I always find it quite weird and I never really know what day of the week it is because, you know, as a writer, work every day. Happy to. But anyway, yes, today I have a great interview with Lucy Hay. And we're talking about screenwriting and tips for treatments and adapting novels. And if you're at all interested in seeing your books on the screen or learning more about screenwriting, then you'll find this fascinating. And I've recently done a treatment for the London Psychic series myself. It's currently with my agent, so we'll see how that goes. As you'll hear in our discussion, there's not much hope for these things, but hey, if you don't put stuff out there, nothing will happen. So yeah, I will obviously update if anything does change on that in the future. Now, in terms of publishing stuff, the Indie Recon videos are now up. You can watch my 50 plus minute video on how to make a living with your writing. There's also Bella Andre and Barbara Freethy talking about selling millions of books, and H.M. Ward on how to sell billions of books. And there's a Q&A session that I did with a whole load of super successful indies, and plus lots more videos and talks, from technical stuff to, you know, things like Ingram Spark, to discussions on the changing role of publishing, and many more at indierecon.org. So you can check those out. They're all up there for free. There's a whole, you know, it's basically a whole education for free on that site, so go and check that out. Other things, David Gochran this week has posted on sort of an update on author solutions and how insidious they are now. I think insidious is such a great word. And, you know, sort of tentacles in all of the big publishers, as well as sites like Lulu and Nook Press. And it's definitely worth having a look at the article because it, you know, it really is buyer beware in the author services market. And I think, you know, I mentioned last show that we know more than we think. And often when I teach classes, so I was at Stratford-on-Avon, Shakespeare's hometown, this week, and it struck me again how far I've come. I mean, you know, since I first started self-publishing, but also how it's just surprising that people don't do their due diligence on things, and especially now when loads of people are sharing all their tips on self-publishing. But you have to know where your line is. So several people in the room kind of said, I wouldn't do it myself. I wouldn't upload a file myself. And, you know, I'm sure many of you who use KDP or Drafter Digital, it is not difficult to, you know, load up ebooks onto these sites. And if you would prefer to pay sort of hundreds or thousands for somebody else to do it for you, I think that's almost like the first step in it not being a successful project. Certainly the people I know who are making decent money from self-publishing, they all do it themselves rather than using a services company. So yeah, anyway, I just wanted to point out David Gochran has that article. I'll link to it in the show notes. But essentially, check out, you know, all the different companies that they're using. In terms of my update, my mega rebranding, it has now happened. And if you go to Amazon or Kobo or iBooks, whatever, my first three books are now called Stone of Fire, Crypt of Bone and Ark of Blood, and they have super new covers. And in this kind of mega post, I go through, you know, essentially why I changed my titles, which sort of comes to the point that none of us know what the hell we're doing when we start writing, and I go into a sort of description of my journey for titles and what I've learned about my branding and how titles and covers are essentially, I mean, in terms of, you know, marketing, people get obsessed with things like social media and tweeting and blogging and podcasting and other things. But actually, our biggest marketing effort is title and cover. I mean, it's crazy. These are so important. So yes, titles and covers. And I also talk about some best practices for titles and how I have actually done the change. Some people have said, won't it confuse people? So the main thing to remember is if you keep on Amazon, which is where Amazon and Kobo actually, if you're keeping the same ASIN or ISBN on Kobo, then it doesn't matter. People can't buy the same book twice. It will actually tell them they've bought it before. So that should get rid of the problem. I've also added previously published as in all the important places. So on Stone of Fire, it says previously published as Pentecost. So hopefully that will fix that. In terms of fiction, I barely sell many copies of my print fiction, so that's not too big a deal. We did have a little glitch. Well, Nook, if you sell a lot on Nook, then it is difficult because essentially you lose your Nook link, and people could buy it again on Nook, but I've made so few sales on Nook that doesn't really matter to me. And I had a few issues with audiobooks as they actually loaded the wrong cover on the wrong book. So that was a bit of a pain, so we had to go through the help desk. Changing three at the same time is probably where that went wrong. If we had just done one at a time, it would have been fine. But essentially, you know, some people have said in the comments, wow, you know, this is really major. Aren't you scared? You're, you know, haven't you made such a big deal about this? And I feel like, you know, I've just had my 40th birthday almost a month ago now, and I feel like this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. A couple of my writing heroes have recently died. Ruth Rendell died yesterday. P.D. James died earlier this year. Obviously, Terry Pratchett. All of these authors have been writing for sort of 50 years, 40, 50 years. I put out my first novel in 2011, so let's face it, I have got a long way to go. So by rebranding now, I actually feel like this is a really good thing to do. I feel like I'm only at the start of my journey as an author. Perhaps you feel the same way. So a lot of the time making these changes feels quite difficult, but it's better to get on with it than wait. I've also redone my jfpen.com website, and I'm really pleased with it, and it now has a big smiley picture on. The going through this rebranding process actually has helped me to realise, because I went through, actually my VA, Alexandra, went through 1,000 of my book reviews, and you know, it's pretty clear that my readers think my books are fun. So I'm going to embrace the fact that my writing is fun and be more fun myself as a fiction author. I think I feel like when I'm writing the books, they're a bit darker, but actually it seems like they're kind of Indiana Jones dark. I mean, you know, there are some scenes in The Temple of Doom which were quite difficult when I was 8 years old or however it was when that came out, but you know, at the end of the day, it's kind of whip cracking fun, and that is what I want to write, action adventure. So yeah, I have redone JF Pen, so you can check that out if you want to have a look. And there's a big smiley face. And I'm also really happy with the new theme. It is a WordPress theme. It's called Author Pro. And I think it's pretty cool. And it's one of those out-of-the-box themes. It only took me an hour and a half to build, which I was super pleased about. And that's the great thing about having a WordPress site, in my opinion. You can just change the skin and the rest of it kind of looks good. So that was cool. What else? I'm in the saggy middle of Deviants in the London Psychic series. I'm at 33,000 words. I have an awesome ending. I'm really happy with the ending, as in I know how it will end, and I've kind of flesh that out. I haven't written it, but I have it fleshed out. I'm really happy with the first third of it. I've got some awesome scenes. I've got a masquerade ball. I've got some very cool things that I'm happy with. A scene at the tattoo convention, which is where I went last year. But I am only 33,000 words in, so I need to finish this first draft, hopefully before the end of May. But I'm pretty busy, actually. I'm speaking at Bristol Crime Fest for a couple of days. I'm speaking this weekend. I spoke last week. So I'm really hoping I can get this done. But the other thing that I've been finding is I've been so tired after my writing sessions. And I was thinking about this from a habit perspective. You know, you read that what you should try and do with your life is cut out the decisions you have to make. So, for example, have the same breakfast every day so that you don't have to think, what shall I have for breakfast? Because every decision you make lowers your self-control, which is why we end up eating biscuits at 3 p.m. but what's so interesting when you're writing fiction, of course, is you're making decisions all the time and you're making stuff up, and that's very draining. So, I wanted to pat everyone on the back. And also, non-fiction is draining too, but I think you have to make fewer decisions when you're writing non-fiction. So I wanted everyone to pat themselves on the back if they have created art this week. So if you've created art, well done. And if you haven't, get on and do it. Here is your kick up the ass as such. What else did I want to say? Oh, yes. A book recommendation, The Story Grid by Sean Coyne, is now out in ebook and paperback. And of course, Sean was on the podcast earlier this year. I think it was pretty much January when Sean was on. And that was a super interview. Yes, it was actually February when Sean was on. So that book is out now, and I've actually been working through it this weekend. So, and it's great for structuring when you get a bit lost. So I've been really enjoying that. It also uses Thomas Harris' Silence of the Lambs as a kind of working example, which I find very helpful in terms of understanding how things work. I'm also working on a non-fiction book of how to make a living with your writing, which will be a more basic version of Business for Authors, which I find Business for Authors really is kind of people who are running a business as an author, but how to make a living with your writing is actually going to be more around what are the different income streams you can have, including blogging, speaking, affiliate income, all of that type of thing. So that will be happening at some point. What else? Oh yes, I wanted to thank everybody who has tweeted me with what they do while listening to the podcast. So last time I shared that Parker was swimming, and I've heard from some of these people. So Lisa is potting tomatoes, Kristen is in her car in Southern California, Monica is ironing, JH Knightley is cleaning, and also says, I love how you always sound so happy. Thank you, JH, and I am super happy, actually. Really, I'm sure you guys realise how much I love what I do, but I kind of wish I'd have done podcasts when I was still really miserable. I guess I did have a podcast when I still hated my job, but I didn't really talk about how much I hated it. What else? Joe Trent does auto repair while listening, which is brilliant. I love that. Auto repair is something I have never done. Don't anticipate doing. Larry Fogel is walking the dog, also driving or cooking or listening at nighttime with insomnia. So I quite like that too. Marika is drawing. Michael is driving on the freeway, windows down, and putting me up at 1.7 speed. And, you know, I thought I might sound like a pixie at 1.7 speed, but Michael says he gets used to it. So there we go. And C.E. Martin listens while summarising medical records at work. It's really awesome to hear what everybody's doing whilst they're listening to the show. And so please, I'd love to hear from anybody else. Please do tweet me at The Creative Pen, and we'll continue with that. Okay, so this podcast episode is sponsored by Kobo Writing Life. And many of you know how much I enjoy using Kobo. But I hear that many of you struggle to get traction on Kobo. So today I thought instead of playing an advert, I would give you my top 5 tips for Kobo. So first of all, go direct via Kobo Writing Life, and you are far more likely to get merchandising that way as a Kobo Writing Life author, because the team at Kobo are, you know, essentially incentivized for their authors. So definitely go direct. Secondly, it really is only worth doing if you have a number of books with great covers. So if you have only one book that's at perma-free, it's unlikely you're going to get traction at Kobo. So I would suggest you need at least 3 books, and to have them at variable prices, and also to have great covers. So remember that Amazon is kind of is algorithm run, whereas Kobo, Apple and Nook are merchandising platforms, which is they promote higher prices or series, and they actually choose, they actually pick things. So like humans pick things. Amazon obviously has that as well, but you can still do fine at Amazon without people picking you. Higher prices do well at Kobo. So I have a couple of box sets there, and they make the most money on Kobo for me. So having box sets of, if you have 3 books in any kind of series, it's well worth making a box set. And in terms of making a box set, you just create a new file with 3 books in and pay a graphic designer to create you an image. So definitely using box sets. Another tip, use the pre-order function and also scheduled price promotions, because when the Kobo merchandisers are looking for things to promote, if they see a good deal coming up, a scheduled price promotion, they may pick it up for merchandising. And also connect with the team. So if you go to a convention, and this is actually true for any of these sites, if you go to a convention, connect with whoever is there from Kobo, comment on the Kobo Writing Life blog. You could offer to do a guest post, get in with the team. They are very open about their names and who they are and what their Twitter handles are and all of that. So a little bit of cyber stalking and prove that you actually have good product, and that will help a lot more. And also, just an extra one, make sure you include the Kobo links on your website and make sure to actually promote the promotions that you get into. So it's a kind of mutual back scratching, like anything else in this game, relationships and having quality product. All right, so this corporate sponsorship pays for the hosting, but my time in producing the show is primarily sponsored by you guys. So a big thank you to all the people supporting on Patreon, and thanks in particular to new supporter Claire Gillen. And on Patreon, you can support me with just a few dollars or even $1 per show to a maximum of 2 shows a month, so less than a coffee a month. And I drink a lot of coffee. You can support the show at patreon.com/thecreativepen. That is patreon.com/thecreativepen. Or of course, you can buy my books. Thank you so much. Let's get on with the interview. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com, and today I'm here with Lucy Hay. Hi Lucy.
Hi Joanna, thanks for having me.
Oh no, it's great to have you on the show. So just a little introduction. Lucy is a novelist, script editor, screenwriter and blogger at bangtowrite.com. She's one of the organisers of London Screenwriters Festival, and she has books on writing thriller and drama screenplays. So Lucy, your site's awesome, as I was just saying, but I wonder if you could start by telling us a bit more about you and your writing background.
Well, my writing background, where do you want me to start? I mean, basically, I've always wanted to be a writer. I think a lot of writers say that, but certainly in my case, it's true. I remember being about 8 and seeing like the novels on my mother's bookcase and thinking, wow, I really like my name. to be on there. And as I got older, I really got into movies as well. And I think I wanted to be a film director at one point. I remember being given a director's chair for my 13th birthday. And I really loved Alien. And even though they were too old for me, really, I was watching them all the time and just thinking it would just be really cool to get involved in just storytelling in general, really. And I went into screenwriting kind of by accident. I ended up going on the screenwriting for film and television course at Bournemouth University and just really falling into script editing from there, really, because I found that although I love writing and I love writing novels, but in terms of writing screenplays, I did enjoy it, but not as much as like picking them apart for other people. I love that. I love the structure of screenplays. You know, they're so specific. Even when we change the structure of a script to something that's not, say, non-linear, it's still very specific. It's not so psychological as a novel, and I really liked that kind of physical world, that visual world, and I like to kind of approach that from the outside, if you like, as a script editor rather than a screenwriter.
Yeah, wow, that's really interesting, because there's so many things that I want to ask you. But let's start by just what are the main differences, I guess, because most of my listeners are authors of books. What are the big differences between a book, writing a novel, and writing a screenplay?
Well, I think the key kind of similarity is that, you know, they're all stories, so in that regard they're the same. I mean, very often when you go to writers' conferences, they'll say, oh, you know, screenwriters should write novels and novelists should write screenplays, and I totally agree with that, because if you can tell a story in one form, you can definitely tell it in another. But there are very certain specifics that you have to do in terms of, I mean, it's much more of a free-for-all a novel. There are obviously things that you have to do in terms of telling the story and anchoring your reader and things like that, obviously. But in terms of screenwriting, I think a lot of people forget that it's a physical world, it's a visual world, and you have to render these psychological processes of the story, these intangible elements, as something that's an image. And so as a result, a lot of scripts that cross my desk are really just chains of dialogue, because that's all the writer can kind of get a handle on. They think, well, that's the kind of physical element of the screenplay, but that's more to do with theatre. Theatre is about characterisation, about dialogue, and obviously about structure as well, but it's not about imagery in the same way that screenplays are. And that's probably the biggest challenge that any screenwriter has, is actually creating an image. It is a lot harder than it looks.
Yeah, it definitely. And we'll come back to treatments in a minute, because I've been writing a treatment. But let's kind of take a step back. So what does the market look like right now? Because we've seen an explosion in possibilities for kind of, you know, movie, TV things. What is the current options for people with screen exploitation, I guess, of rights?
In terms of rights, then obviously the internet has opened everything up wide, and self-publishers and indie publishers in particular now have a lot more kind of options available to them in terms of actually pursuing their own projects and getting their own stuff made and adapted from their original source material into web series, television projects, various different, you know, short films, feature films, you know, things like that. And certainly there's lots of really great sites now that people don't even necessarily need an agent to help them negotiate that anymore, because there's a lot of information online. There's IPRlicense.com as well, which is, I think, is associated with Legend Press. They do a great job of advising authors on the rights that they can sell. To different marketplaces. And it's also worth remembering the different languages as well. Like one of my books sold in Germany, for instance. A friend of mine wrote a best-selling mystery novel that sold the television rights over in France, for instance. You know, so it's not just English language or the language that you're writing in. It's many, many different ways of exploiting things. There's different, depending on your audience as well. There's things like merchandising rights as well, toys and things associated with that story world. You know, like Harry Potter had all the different kind of maps of the story world and the Hobbit and all that kind of stuff. You know, graphic novels is a big thing of the moment as well. So really, you know, the sky's the limit, and you don't necessarily need an agent, but you do have to have a strategy. You do have to decide, you know, what you want to happen next for your intellectual property and how to go out there and get it, because anything can happen. And you can if an audience wants it, you can get there.
Yeah. Yes. And it was interesting. I was just at the London Book Fair and I went to a session with a load of producers, and this guy said, look, there just isn't enough content for us to, you know, put out there right now for us to buy. And I was really surprised, because I feel like, you know, we all feel in the, as authors, that there's this kind of glut and there's this tsunami of stuff. So obviously these producers and people like yourself don't go around reading all the books. So how do we get the attention of the right people?
Well, pitching is the key, really, and getting out there and making sure that people know about your work and know that about its possibilities and know about how it can work for them. I mean, I think one of the reasons that a lot of producers and agents and people at the selling level feel that there isn't enough content is that pitching, especially in the UK, it's really bad. Yes. You know, you go to a lot of conferences and you hear, you know, you ask writers what they're working on, and they give you this very long rambling kind of thing where you come away and you think, I didn't actually learn anything about that project at all. You know, writers need to understand that they're selling things at concept level, and that essentially, I mean, screenwriters get it a lot better than novelists a lot of the time, because they have to reduce everything to the log line, which is like, you know, a little story sentence that kind of encapsulates what your project is. And I think it would really help a lot of novelists who want their work adapted to actually think of it in screenwriting terms, you know, how to take it at log line level to treatment level to extended pitch level, you know, take it into these virtual pitch fests or conferences, book fairs and so on, and actually search out these producers themselves rather than hoping that they'll just randomly come to them.
And of course, many authors are introverts, and the kind of the worst thing possible is to go into a pitching session. And I've been to one, and it's actually quite terrifying.
It is.
You know, and you realise how bad you are when you know, even if you practice. So what are some of your tips for one of those kind of those 3-minute pitch sessions?
Well, we run a pitch fest at London Screenwriters every year, and so I'll often write kind of pitch fest guides on the website at londonscreenwritersfestival.com. But I think really knowing your log line inside out is absolutely key. A good log line is usually in the region of 25 to 60 words, and having a good sense of tone, genre, the characters. You know, I talk about the 3 C's of pitching, which is character, you know, who your character is, what they want, the conflict, you know, what they're up against, and then also clarity as well, because you've got to be clear and it's got to be straightforward, and you've got to be able to grab that person within. I mean, they say that you can tell a great pitch within the first 30 seconds. And certainly that's always been my experience. You know, when someone sits in front of me at London Screenwriters or any other writer in any other kind of situation, I usually go, yeah, straight away, or no. It is as quick as that. And sometimes a pitch can be really excellent. It's just not of any interest to me. If somebody's going to sit opposite me and say it's a zombie screenplay, I'm immediately going to go, no. It doesn't matter how good it is. I'm not interested in zombies. So doing research of who you're pitching to is another key element. I mean, someone came to me the other day and said, I've got a screenplay, it's female protagonist, obviously, I'm interested in that, and she's powerful, she's sexy, she gets her kit off. I know you like all of that, he says. And I said, yeah, I do. I do like all of that stuff. I like sexy thrillers. I like the solving of mysteries. I like female protagonists. So immediately he's kind of setting the scene, making me interested in what he's got. Mm. So that can help as well. So that plus, knowing who you're pitching to, doing your research, setting the scene, having your three C's, your characters, your conflict, your clarity, all of those are key in getting someone interested in your idea at pitch level.
Mm. And don't mean to put you on the spot, but can you actually give an example of a log line, like a good log line?
Oh, goodness. I mean, most of the log lines that I read have got like NDAs attached, which means non-disclosure agreements, so I'm not supposed to talk about them. But I mean, if you actually Google log lines, you'll find the log lines for many different movies that are already made, for example. I mean, one that I use frequently in classes is probably for Alien, which would be, everybody knows, in space, no one can hear you scream. But that's actually the tagline. That's to do with the PR campaign. That's not actually anything to do with the log line. And that's something that writers mistake all the time. And log lines are not taglines. So if the tagline of Alien is, in space, no one can hear you scream, then the log line is, seven space truckers pick up a hostile alien life form, which picks them off one by one.
So it's more of a description of the overall description of the whole book, which is
essentially
really hard. It's really, really hard.
It's very, very hard.
Yeah, and it's so interesting learning about this stuff, because part of me thinks, well, you should start with the log line. Like, you should try, before you write a novel, you should write the log line. And because when you try and do it the other way, it's really much more difficult.
Yes, I think, I actually do start my novels, my own novels, with a log line. I always try and write it that way. And certainly I think screenwriting can help novelists a lot. So I always actually would recommend any novelist do even just a short screenwriting course, a crash course, if you like, or read a book a way of actually kind of working their way through their novel as they would through a screenplay, I think can pay dividends, definitely. Mm.
Yeah, I've got a whole stack on my desk at the moment of screenplay. I've got Terminator 2 and Thelma and Louise on my desk.
That's a great one.
Yeah. But that's interesting. So we've talked a bit there about the log line. The treatment, can you explain kind of what a treatment is? Because it's definitely something that most authors won't have come across before.
Well, I mean, treatment is kind of like an outline, really. A treatment, it does depend who you're speaking to. Traditionally, a treatment is a selling document. Mm. And basically, it's a blow-by-blow account of the plot and how it works out in the screenplay. Ideally, it should be between... I mean, we talk a lot these days about sizzlers, which are like three-page treatments. And they're supposed to sizzle, as their name suggests, and they're supposed to be really, really interesting and tell the story blow by blow and actually draw you into that world. It's something that agents can read, that producers can read, that investors can read without necessarily having to read the entire screenplay. So it's kind of like a diluted version, but a lot of people think it's that then they've got to write it, very boringly, but you can't. You've got to write it in a really interesting way that really grabs people, that makes like investors in particular want to part with their money. So, three, four pages is about, I mean, you used to get away with like 10, 12, 15 pages, but these days it's three or four, it's always changing all the time.
Oh dear, mine's seven. So I might have to revisit that. Yeah. But it's so fascinating. And what's interesting as well, you talk about that's a selling document and the word investor, which is something you don't really hear in the sort of literary world so much. But this is what I also like about screenwriting, because it is about getting the work made, isn't it? It's about getting people to fund it. But what is the reality of, okay, say that people are really happy and they buy it and whatever. Can you sort of explain the reality of how many of these get optioned and how many of these get made and how it kind of works?
Well, I mean, how long is a piece of string, you know? I mean, if you get your screenplay optioned at all, then that's pretty cool, because probably I wouldn't even say 10% of scripts get optioned or made at all. You know, it's really, really hard. And certainly people will actually promise you money and then money will disappear. And, you know, there's lots and lots of false starts when it comes to movies. I think I was talking in my book about drama screenplays about how Dallas Buyers Club was the most stalled screenplay in Hollywood for 22 years. Oh, and producer Cassian Newell's lost the money 3, 4, 5 times. You know, he actually ended up having to basically strong arm money out of somebody whose job he'd given like 10 years before. You know, the guy didn't even want to make Dallas Buyers Club. He was like, you know, just give me some money, any money, I don't care. And he was like, oh, all right then. Which just seems crazy, you know. I mean, they're very much Triumph of Hope over Experience movies. Very often what will happen is if you want to make, a lot of writer-directors will just make their own film. So they'll like bypass all of the option process and getting other people interested. They'll set themselves up, they'll attach a producer, they'll go after money, often with private investors or with BFI or screen agencies. Very often people will only offer up half the money. And there's lots of like really complicated laws where somebody can't just give you a stack of money to make a film. Mm-hmm. Because of like tax and things like that. It's really complicated. So they'll say, we'll give you half. So you've got to match it from another source, or you've got to get from other places. You've got to get a certain amount of stuff that's in kind as well, you know, like free people working on it or free equipment. And, you know, it's balancing all these crazy things all the time. There's also private investment companies whose job it is just to fund movies, and they're like tax losses for other companies. Mm. And then there's banks who like offer loans to make films that are kind of like mortgages, basically. But then the bank owns the film. Once you've paid them back, then the film is yours, but it has to get into a certain amount of profit. And oh god, the comp is so complicated, it's crazy. And then there's all the different options as well at like the base level. A lot of writers, especially first time writers, will find themselves signing free options to a producer. So a producer will come along and say, I want exclusive rights to this screenplay for a certain amount of time, and I will work at try and raise the money to make it, but I don't have any money up front, so your payment will come when I've raised the money. Mm-hmm. Those can be great deals or they can be terrible deals. It does depend. Certainly, I've signed on projects that are free options that have worked out brilliantly, and that has catapulted people into situations where they could command a lot of money later, or on projects later in their careers as well. But if a writer is signing a free option, I always say to them, you know, you've got to work out how good that option is. Mm-hmm. For you. Never let a producer have your script for like 5 years for free. You know, 6 months to a year, I think, is enough time. Maybe 18 months at a push, but certainly no more than that. And also, do they have a good track record for raising money? You know, how many films have they made before? You know, how well did they do? Is this their first film? Just because it's their first film doesn't mean that they're not good. So find out from their peers if they're any good. You know, there are some sharks around, definitely. But most producers just want what you want, which is to make a film. Mm. And to get out there and it be really successful and make lots of money and or hopefully get some kudos with awards or whatever their strategy is. I find usually it's either money or awards. It's rarely both.
Same with books.
Yeah. So, I mean, it depends what type of story this is. You know, sometimes people are going for the kudos. They want the awards. They want Oscars, BAFTAs, all that kind of stuff. Or they want to do something that has, like, issues attached that's really big and important and it has a big message to it, you know, that it might be for that reason. Other times, you know, they want to get in the DVD chart, they want to be able to sell lots of units. You know, I don't think either side is worse than the other. I think they both, I actually like to work on projects that do both. You know, I've been involved in projects that are award winners and I've been involved in projects that have made a lot of money, and both have their own challenges and both are equally interesting.
And just so you know, just to recap there, people, you know, often people will get an option, you know, among the author community, people will say, oh, I've got an option, but actually that means pretty much nothing. It could be a free option, they could get no money, it might never get made, it's not that big a deal to get option. But the follow-on question there, if you only write the book but you don't write the screenplay, does that affect how the money works out later? Because obviously someone will need to adapt that. And do you recommend that authors do this, do at least the first draft of a screenplay because of the writing credit?
It can depend. I mean, sometimes authors like to be really involved and sometimes they don't. I mean, we all know about Gillian Flynn, for example, and she's done stupendously well, and her adaptation of Gone Girl was masterly and amazing, and everybody loved it, and it was a very, very good adaptation. Mm-hmm. And I don't know her, and I don't know anything about the background of that project, but I would imagine that she probably instructed her agent that she wanted to be into this adaptation from the start. And so I would imagine if David Fincher hadn't approached her, she would have probably packaged it up with a first draft and a treatment and a one-page pitch and a whole package to show that she could do it and that she was, you know, a serious person who could do it, because it's all about, can you deliver in screenwriting? Screenwriting is, when it comes to meetings, it's all about, you know, can you deliver by a certain amount of time? So I would imagine she packaged it all up in advance. So if you're dead set on being involved in your own adaptation, I would say that was probably a good idea. That said, there are other ways of doing it. Certainly I've known writers in the past go to their agents in particular, especially if their agents represent screenwriters too, and say, I really want to do an adaptation of my book, and I want you to pair me with a screenwriter to write it with them, or to package it with them. Can you make that happen? And I've seen that happen lots of times. And at my agents, at Blake Friedman, there was Trisha Walker's Benedict's brother. She wanted to adapt her own novel, and she did that. You know, she got her agent involved to actually get her a screenwriter to advise her on that process. I think she wrote the adaptation herself in the end, but she had like a screenwriter with more experience kind of advising her in the process as it go along. Other times it's more kind of equal and it's two people together. Mm. A screenwriter and a novelist together, and it's all about proving that you can do it, that you can deliver.
Mm. And let's face it, the first time any of us do anything, it's never very good. And learning to write a screenplay is a different skill. So this is something I think about all the time. Like, part of me really wants to write a screenplay, and then the other part thinks, if I write another novel, I know I can make money on that. Whereas with a screenplay, there's no guarantee that you're going to make money, is there? There's no guarantee it will sell. And as you said, most of them don't, actually.
Nah.
which is crazy. But so you have your book, Writing and Selling a Thriller Screenplay, and you also have the drama screenplay, has a great discussion of thriller as genre. And a lot of authors shy away from genre, but maybe you could explain why genre is so important with screenwriting.
When it comes, screenwriting, we talk about genre and then we talk about drama, basically. Genre is all about those kind of big stories, those high concept stories, whereas drama is pretty much the minutiae of life and everything else, you know, the biopics and the famous struggles of famous people and inspirational stories of against adversity, things like that. So the little things about little people and the human emotions is drama. Genre then is... those big things, and it's all about convention. Like every type of genre has its own kind of defining characteristics, because audiences need to know what they're signing up for. You know, when a big movie like Jurassic Park, for instance, it's, you know, that you don't get more genrefied than that. It's, you know, it's a big, gigantic movie about dinosaurs running amok on an island, and you know that's what people want. They go for the plots and they come away happy because of the characters, I think. So I think it's really important to be able to actually kind of sell up front what your story is about in genre. I mean, there's a reason that drama movies don't do as well as genre. I mean, occasionally you get like breakout hit dramas, you know, get like The King's Speech, for example, did very well at the box office. But that's usually a bonus. It's not going to happen as standard. And the reason that people don't sign up in droves for dramas is because they don't always know what they're about. You know, you can actually look at the box and you go, oh, okay, I get it, it's a love story, or it's the story of a man who did whatever, but it's not got that kind of visceral pull. It's about curiosity, really. And you go to these see these movies, like something like Blue Valentine, for instance, an extraordinarily devastating movie about a marriage breakdown. And it's really realistic, and it's brilliantly done, and it's beautiful and devastating and completely and utterly depressing. You know, who wants to see that at the end of a week? You know, I was watching it. It was really cathartic and wonderful. It was beautifully acted, beautifully written, beautifully directed, and I was crying buckets, but you have to be in the mood for that, you know. Whereas I would love to go and see Jurassic Park whenever. You know, who doesn't want to see people being eaten by dinosaurs? I love dinosaurs, and I love high octane chases. And yeah, there's some quite deep philosophical stuff in Jurassic Park. They talk about the rape of the natural world. Mm-hmm. They talk about discovery. They talk about power and the illusion of control. You know, quite deep stuff. But ultimately, it's about dinosaurs eating people. That's what it's about. And people, who doesn't want to see dinosaurs eating people? Who wants to see a marriage breakdown? You know, your marriage might be breaking down right this moment. You don't want to see a movie about it as well. You know, but you might want to see a dinosaur eating someone who looks like your ex-husband, you know, maybe.
And this is actually really funny, because, and I said to you before that your website is really good for that kind of lightheartedness around stuff, because I feel like we all get so serious all the time, and like everyone's like, we have to write something really serious and prize winningy. But you know, is it realistically, we're writing entertainment, is that what it comes down to?
Absolutely. Entertainment is absolutely key, and the entertainment aspect of this spec pile in general is extremely low, really, really low. Most of the time I'm reading stuff that is far too serious for its own good, and even stuff about dinosaurs eating people will be really, really serious. And it's, you know, we want to be entertained. We don't want to be educated necessarily. We don't want to be shocked necessarily. We don't want to be inspired. We just want to be entertained. We want a good story well told. That's all we want. And obviously that means different things to different people, and it means different things in different story contexts. But at the end of the day, whatever you do within that context, you have to do it well, and you have to do it in an entertaining way. The reason that so many big directors in particular are so popular. You know, the Michael Bays, the Steven Spielbergs, Christopher Nolans, doesn't matter what you think of them. They are masters of entertainment. They know who their target audience is. They know how to entertain them and they do it well, you know, regardless of whether we personally like it or not. So that's what we have to do. We have to find out who our audience is, you know, who we want to speak to, and we have to know what we want to speak about. And we have to do it in such a way that we can entertain our target audience. And I think the average screenwriter who's yet to break through hasn't really grasped that and doesn't know what they want to talk about, who they want to talk to. They don't know who their audience is, and as a result, if you don't know who your audience is, then you can't entertain them.
So do you recommend that you know, authors really sort of watch the movies that they want to write something similar to and kind of break them down and work out why they're so popular?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, very often somebody will come to me and say, oh, you know, I really want to write a supernatural thriller or a supernatural horror, but I haven't watched any because I don't want to be influenced. It's like, seriously? It's like, you can't break new ground without knowing what's gone before. You have to steep yourself in whatever genre you want to write in, or whatever type of story. You know, if you want to write a drama, you have to watch loads of dramas. You have to identify the movies that you like and the stories that you like, and take from that the best bits and actually put your own new slant on them. And you can't do that if you don't know what's gone before. And yet people will absolutely insist that they can't, because then they'll just end up copying. And yet the irony is they actually end up copying because they just kind of absorbed stuff kind of in their peripheral vision that they then just churn out, and it's just stock characters, stock situations, and it's just like cliche after cliche, and it's just so boring.
So what's your favourite, you know, so I write thrillers, but, you know, what would be your top film that you're like, go watch this, read the screenplay?
Oh, God, there's so many. You know, it depends on the day. I mean, I love Thelma and Louise. I remember watching that as a girl and just being, wow, it's amazing. Love Alien. Alien's a great film. I never get bored of watching Alien. I saw the 35th anniversary screening in London last year, and that was a massive thrill because I got to see it on the big screen for the first time. You know, really, the work of Ridley Scott in sort of like the 80s and the early 90s was just, it's just exceptional. It was really good. You know, stuff like Legend and other things like The Abyss, James Cameron's The Abyss. I love that. You know, it's one of his forgotten films. You know, now Avatar and T2 have eclipsed it, but I thought The Abyss was just so special and wonderful, and you know, had a real human element to the storytelling that maybe wasn't in other pieces of his, for me anyway. I really loved the work of Oren Peli, the guy who did Paranormal Activity. I love the stuff that's coming out of his studio, things like Sinister, Insidious, stories about parenthood and negotiating parenthood and keeping your children safe and maybe failing them, you know, because obviously that's a big concern for parents, and he's really got into that kind of psyche, that element of supernatural horror really, really well with Mr. Boogie and Sinister in particular. He was great, loved that character. And the whole kind of astral travelling thing with Insidious, I loved. I thought the first Saw was really awesome. I thought that changed the horror genre. Not necessarily for the better in the long term, because it turned really nasty for a long time with the torture porn kind of subgenre. But, you know, that first Saw was really exciting. You know, this thought that you could take, you know, 50 grand or whatever it was and just turn it into this massive franchise, you know, amazing. You know, that's everybody's dream, to take, you know, a tiny little indie film and turn it into this massive 7-picture franchise that everyone was obsessed with for so long. And, you know, it's there's just so many great things. And also rom-coms, I think, are really cool at the moment.
Mm.
And they went through a stage where they were a bit too blokey for my tastes, you know, the Seth Rogen kind of stuff. And now we're into stuff where maybe the men are more naked than the women, which is nice. And things like Friends with Benefits, you know, Justin Timberlake, love that. I loved that one with Steve Carell and Julianne Moore, Crazy Stupid Love, that. You know, there's some really, really good human stories there about love that are real and seem relevant, you know, that aren't just all fairy tales all the time. Stuff like 500 Days of Summer was a great film, really relevant to me, really, it was an anti-rom-com, if you like, I thought it was really cool.
Oh, great. Well, and you've given such a gamut there of things that you like, which is brilliant. And people should kind of be dipping into everything, right, in order to find things. But I also love your enthusiasm. So tell people a bit more about what they can find at your website.
Well, my website is about demystifying the kind of screenwriting process and the writing process in general. I don't write predominantly about novel writing so much as just creative writing, although I do write the odd post about novel writing from time to time, especially about description, because when I do read novels for people, I find the description is usually the thing that needs the most work, and also structure as well, because that's my thing. I find a lot of indie authors in particular write great characters, but maybe their structure is all over the place, so I often advise about those two things. So I'll write about those in terms of novel writing, but also I write about writing careers and strategies and submission processes in general, because I'm very often the person on the other side of the submission process, either for screenwriting competitions or when people submit various pieces for my consideration. And some of the processes that people go through are very strange indeed. So I think it's I write a column for Script Mag called Submissions Insanity. And so I'll write about that on Bang to Write as well, about how not to submit to people, especially agents, because I'll often be talking to agents about the crazy submissions that they get, because I get the same at competitions and various initiatives, especially at London Screenwriters. So and I'll write about just the notion of being a writer as well, because it's hard, you know, it's very solitary writing, and you have to kind of be, if you want other people's validation, you're not going to get it. So you have to remember that you have to be your own biggest fan. Mm-hmm. And I find that a lot of female writers will often come to me in kind of almost like a counselling kind of capacity. It's like, you can do this. You can do this. You can get out to the other side. And also there's free writing resources as well. There's downloads that people can access, and I've made lists of various podcasts I've been in, like this one, and videos. You know, there's some video there from London Screenwriters, things like that, that people can access for free, and e-libraries, and my Pinterest as well, because I've got very specific kind of interests in story about representations of masculinity in film, representations of women in film, things like that, and crazy stories, because truth is stranger than fiction. So I love to actually kind of collect mad items of news as well, things like that, so which all can be accessed at Bang to Write.
It is a brilliant resource. So just give people the website address again, and also your Twitter handle.
Okay, it's Bang to Write, which is BANG, the number 2, WRIT. WRITE, and that's bangtowrite.com, and then I'm Bang to Write on Twitter as well.
Fantastic. Well, look, thanks so much for your time, Lucy. That was great.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. You can also get your free Author 2.0 blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.